is up. Welcome to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. I'm Jamie Dodd. My co-host, of course, is Thomas Durant, who also covers the Canucks at The Athletic. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Drance, getting connected. You'll be shocked to hear that there's some issues with the connection here, but we're going to get it as set up well and close to perfect as we can here to start the show. So Drance will join us momentarily. Schedule update for today. Of course, it is Wednesday, which typically means the crossover with our pals Donnie and Dolly, but we're going to move that to Thursday, a mysterious cancellation, or at least a postponement from the Donnie and Dolly side. So we'll have to get the update on Dolly's banana intake tomorrow. I know it's going to be tough to go 24 hours without that, but we will do the crossover with the fellas on tomorrow's show. We do still have Jason Bukla coming up later today, our other Wednesday staple. He's going to join us at 1:30 today instead of 1. And of course, lots to get into with Books, whose final draft ranking is up at sportsnet.ca. We can talk to him about that. We can talk to him, of course, about the Stanley Cup final, which wrapped up last night as well. So no guests until Books at 1:30, and again, we're going to get Drance here momentarily on the show. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. You can send your thoughts in, and we got to start, obviously, with the official end of the 2024-25 NHL season, and it ends pretty much exactly the same as it did last year, with the Florida Panthers claiming the Stanley Cup, their second consecutive Stanley Cup. They beat Edmonton again in the finals, this time in six games, thanks to a resounding 5-1 win last night. And it was local product again. Sam Reinhardt again showing up big in the clinching game. Of course, scored the clinching goal last year. This time he scores four goals, including an absolutely ridiculous one to open the scoring in that one for Florida, as they cruise ultimately to a comfortable victory against the Edmonton Oilers. Sam Bennett wins the Conn Smythe with 15 goals in the playoffs. Close vote with Brad Marchand in second place there, the clear second place finisher in the Conn Smythe total. And we're going to have a lot of time now to kind of reflect and think about what we saw from Florida. Where do they go from here? What's next for them? What's next for Edmonton? Certainly. But I think today is just simply about recognizing the greatness that was on display from the Florida Panthers in this series, in this playoffs, over the last 2 years. Heck, you even want to go back 3 years to when they made the final against Vegas. This stretch of dominance from Florida, it was simply an overwhelming, again, dominant performance in every way. And I think the correct discussion to have here, and I've seen, you know, people start to have the semantic argument about a dynasty, and I don't know. I don't want to get too bogged down in that. Does it have to be three? Does it have to be in a row, et cetera, et cetera? But to me, the question starts to become, where do they rank with great teams from the past? And you can do cap era. You can do going back further than that. Obviously, it's a little hard to judge when you go back into the 90s and the 80s and the rules were so different. But I think that's the conversation with Florida is, are they the greatest team? Has this been the greatest stretch in the cap era in the NHL? To me, the other contenders would be the Chicago Blackhawks when they won three Stanley Cups in short succession there, and they were similarly just absolutely loaded top to bottom, much like this Florida Panthers team was, especially up front. I think you got to throw Tampa Bay in there as well, who of course won back to back and went to three Stanley Cup finals. I think, though, for me, it is between the Chicago teams and these Florida teams. And the reason I would have Florida ahead of Tampa Bay, and I don't, it wouldn't be really a debate for me, is because you look at who Florida beat in the playoffs. They beat Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl. And again, there's going to be a lot of nitpicking about, oh, can you really build a winning team around those two players? And what were the flaws of Edmonton? Edmonton was a phenomenal team this year. Look how they dispatched Vegas. Look how they handled Dallas. Great teams in their own right. Edmonton barely had to break a sweat to beat those teams. So are there flaws with Edmonton? Yeah, of course there are. But they are also undeniably an incredibly talented championship caliber team. And Florida beat them twice in a row in the Stanley Cup Finals. You look back to Tampa Bay's run. They beat Montreal the first year, or sorry, they beat Dallas the first year in the bubble, and then they beat Montreal the next year in the North Division season. And if you're just to rank the teams that have made the Stanley Cup final over the course of the last six seasons, either won or lost it there, I think those two teams, Dallas and Montreal, are probably finishing at the bottom of your rankings. Anyways, now joining us fresh with a connection here, remote, it is Thomas Drantz, my co-host. Drantzer, what's going on, man?
It was funny how when we first started doing this show, we were so good at doing remote radio.
Were we?
I think so.
I don't remember that. I don't remember that era.
Fair enough. Anyway, good to be with you.
I think earlier this year was our greatest run of sustained success doing it.
Yeah, I think so too.
And now we've fallen off. We got fat and happy and we fell off. We took our eyes off the prize.
That fat and happy, the Thomas Drantz story. Anyway, good to be with you. Florida Panthers champions again. What a deserving two-time Stanley Cup winner. Incredible, too,
yeah.
Because they have runway, man. You know, like, most of these guys are under the age of 30.
Mm-hmm.
Barkov's 29. Reinhardt's 29. Kachuk's 27. I mean, you've got Bobrovsky at $10 million for only one more year. You know, what are the chances at 37... you know, and after another season that he re-signs, even does like the old Matt Sundin, goes year by year to stay in Florida, right? It might be cap relief coming from their starter. And then you've got, you know, they've got cap flexibility. Like, they've got actual cap flexibility. Obviously, they have really good players to sign here. Sam Bennett being the headliner. Did you see the videos at Elba Room?
Mm-hmm.
Fans chanting eight more years at Sam Bennett as he crushes beers.
Yep.
Pretty incredible. Yeah, but, you know, you've got Bennett, you've got Marchand, you've got Ekblad. I'd guess that they maybe take a bigger run at the two forwards than at the defender, to be totally honest with you, which I know is probably like brain-breaking, given that Ekblad has played his entire career in Florida and Marchand's been there for a minute and Bennett for like 3 years. But I'd guess that's how they prioritize it, just based off of, frankly, their ability to plug and play and get so much out of whatever defender they go out and acquire.
Yep.
I mean, Seth Jones kind of left for dead by the NHL commentariat at the side of the road, right? Played great for them. Nico Mikkola, low upside, glass and out guy.
Well, and
we sure about that?
Who was the high-profile guy they let after the first one, right? It was Brandon Montour from the back end. So it does fit with the history of, if we're going to move on, it's going to be from the guys on the blue line because we think we can go find the next, you know, Nate Schmidt, Nico Mikkola, Seth Jones combination to bring in and stabilize.
100%. And like, you know, Dr. Emile Zola, you're talking to Tommy Lee Jones as he eats a steak in the first Captain America, right? It's like, you know, the sanity of the plan is of no consequence because they can do it. Like, they have $20 million in cap space.
Mm-hmm.
They can absolutely sign two of these guys or all three if they can get them all in a room and be like, hey, guys, should we take a run at the 80s Islanders? Should we take a run at getting six of us into the Hall of Fame? Like, what do we want to do here?
Yeah.
You know, and that's how well positioned they are. This is not a team, in contrast, like the Oilers, with Dreisaitl's salary going up and Bouchard needing a new deal and McDavid becoming extension eligible on July 1. I mean, this felt do or die
plus
this
age,
era.
Plus goaltending questions. Like, Edmonton has way more questions about their ability to keep running it back and their ability to keep betting back to this stage than Florida does at this point.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not the thing that is so striking to me is it's not just everything you're laying out, which is correct about their age and their ability to keep it together and keep running it back and plugging holes. But so this was 3 years in a row in the Stanley Cup final for them. And of course, winning the last two. And you even think back to the very recent example of another team doing that, the Tampa Bay Lightning, where they won the first two and then lost in the third one. And in that third one, there was a sense of, oh, the miles are catching up, right? Like, they're running on fumes a little bit. Like, Colorado's just so much fresher. They're more athletic. They're faster. And Tampa Bay, like, hey, credit to them. Those old guys, they found a way to get back there, but, like, they just don't have enough left in the tank. That there was zero of that feeling with Florida. In fact, I think you could argue in their, like, at the end of their third consecutive Stanley Cup final run, they were playing the best hockey we've seen them play in that 3-year stretch, right? And I don't just mean in the Stanley Cup final, but I was going back through the game log today. Since they went down 2-0 against the Leafs in that second round series, okay, they played 16 games after that. They went 12-4. They outscored their opponents 68-35 in those 16 games. That's plus 33 in 16 games, most of which were in the conference finals and the Stanley Cup final. Like, that's an absurd level of performance. That might be the best stretch within a Stanley Cup playoffs that we've seen in the Cap era. When you really think about the opponents they were going up against, the fact that it was their third run in a row, to hit that level and sustain it for 16 games to wrap up your second consecutive Stanley Cup is just insane. And that, to me, might be the biggest reason to think they're not done by a long shot. Like, there was no, oh man, they snuck one last one in here before time and age catches up to them. There was zero of that feeling.
No. And look, windows end faster than we think, right? Yes. I mean, this team feels unassailable because we just saw them do it. You know, I mean, that is in and of itself an illusion. You know, some of what, for example, the Oilers dealt with in, you know, I'm thinking things like, you know, Ekholm, right, was not clearly the player that we saw in the playoffs last year, sort of rushing back from injury the way he did to be part of this. You know, and credit to him, like, what a warrior. But, you know, that caught up with him. I mean, what was that pass to Bouchard? Bouchard needed to do better with it too, but that wasn't peak Ekholm.
Nope.
And they don't have Hyman in this series. And boy, could you feel that absence as this game went along. So, you know, there's an element to which I'm always cautious. I want to be careful about sort of anointing a team as having some unlimited window, because that's just not how hockey works. And the entire history of this game teaches us that. This is a really hard level to sustain. It's a really hard level to get back to. And so I'm not predicting that they will. I'm not suggesting that some red curtain has fallen across North American professional hockey inexorably across the next several years. But they've got an opportunity ahead of them here. And it kind of starts with the decisions that Bennett, Marchand, and Ekblad make over the course of the next 2 weeks. But it's deeper than that. It's whether or not they can keep finding Nate Schmidt.
Yes.
Right. There's not going to be as many buyouts this year. There's going to be less low-hanging fruit. There's going to be more resources. There are young teams that have been stockpiling, you know, assets and high-end talent that are younger and hungry and have $40 million in cap space this summer. And as much as people want to talk about state taxes or whatever, how nice it is to live in Florida, you know, Matthew Tkachuk, did you see the Matthew Tkachuk quote about McDavid winning one eventually somewhere?
Yes.
It's like, man, guy can't stop recruiting.
Well, and
he
also
is always recruiting.
But also, like, throwing the barb about, like, yeah, unlike those guys, we're not a bunch of individuals. You know, we won because we're a team. I was like, oh my gosh, you just beat them. Stop, they're already dead.
And all they do is say nice things about their opponents.
Yeah.
Like, the Leafs thing was unbelievable, right? Where they're
so
just
funny,
like, killing them with kindness. And then you know how they really feel, you know?
And
in this case, like, they beat the Oilers twice in a row in the cup final. They probably have a sense that, you know, there's things that are going to become unwound here. It's going to be very hard for the Oilers to sustain stuff. And boom, you know, they're finally, after 24 months of rivalry, Matthew Tkachuk twists the knife. Like, brilliant stuff. I also think, really quickly, because we should touch on the you know, continuation of the Canadian Stanley Cup drought.
Sure.
Which is, you know, now drinking age in the United States. And I think there's like a neat symmetry here where the Panthers beat the Maple Leafs in seven.
Mm-hmm.
And they got Brad Marchand from the Bruins. And they got Seth Jones. And the Maple Leafs paid more for Brandon Carlo than the Panthers paid for Seth Jones. And they got Brad Marchand from the Boston Bruins. And it's just like there's an extent to which...
While like, the Leafs got obviously, Scott Laughton from Philly.
Yeah, yeah, right. But it's like they got the right Bruin. Mm-hmm. They got the guy who's going to probably be a Hall of Famer. They've got the guy who's got the personality, you know, to be that X factor, you know, rat difference maker, scoring double overtime game winners in the Stanley Cup final. And the Maple Leafs got Brandon Carlo. And I just was struck by how telling it is that as this Cup final went along, the credible reports that the Oilers are going to sign Trent Frederick,
who didn't have a single productive touch. Mm-hmm.
He didn't have a single productive puck touch in that series. And they traded, what, a second and a fourth for him?
Yep.
The Panthers gave up a conditional second for Marchand. Becomes a first, but only because they're so, so sick. And it's like they also traded for the wrong Bruin. And then what happens? They end up in a Cup final, Game 7, legacy-defining game for Dreisaitl and McDavid. And they're playing 40-year-old Corey Perry on their line. And the worst part about that is not that 40-year-old Corey Perry is their best option as a break glass in case of emergency. Let's load up the top line sort of weapon for Knobloch to yield. It's that that was the right decision.
Yes.
That was the best call available to him. And I just struggle with that so much. It's just so representative of what's really happening. And then people are going to say stuff, you know, the negative hockey fans who love to complain about officiating and watch the game emotionally and immediately pivot from LTI manipulation is why Vegas and Tampa Bay are unassailable to state taxes are the whole ball game. The state taxes are the cherry on top, right? Players don't even get that benefit when they're on the road. Like, at most, you're talking about something that matters for the UFAs in a lineup or on a payroll. When they're at home, we're talking about a 2% cash edge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, if it even impacts this one bucket of players, from a team's perspective, we're talking about them getting a 2% break total relative to the assembly of their team under the hard cap. Like, what are we doing? That's the cherry on top of the sundae. The sundae itself is, oh my God, the Panthers have 8 top-line caliber forwards and Evan Rodriguez and a fourth line that played really well and a reliable starting goaltender and this defensive depth and Nate Schmidt on a one-year deal. And, man, they're also in the Calder Cup final. And they've got a 23-year-old right-handed defender who's been their best player on that run. I mean, don't miss the forest for the trees here. The assembly of this group. You know, people go back and they'll be like, can you imagine getting Sam Bennett for a second in Emil Heinemann? And it's like, yeah, at the time, because I saw him and everyone saw him as this undisciplined bottom six forward who couldn't win draws, hadn't stuck at center, couldn't carve out a role, and took offensive zone penalties of the laziest variety at like the highest clip anyone's ever seen. Like, Sam Bennett was not a slam dunk to be a Conn Smythe winner
when
he was acquired.
To say the least.
Sam Reinhart was not the smartest guy in hockey. The highest hockey IQ winger in the league, he was not that when they acquired him for a first and Devon Levi, when no one else really had the cap space to even swing the bat at that. I mean, that was a swing. These bets hit. And in retrospect, it looks insane, but that's because they were great bets on high upside guys who came with significant question marks the day they were acquired. And they've not only made smart bets on high pedigree, high upside players, they've not only made those bets at extraordinary volume, it's not just that they've been super aggressive about it, but they've maximized every asset they've been able to lay their hands on. And like, that's the sundae, that's the ice cream, that's the whipped cream, that's the chocolate sauce. Talking about state taxes, man, it is exhausting. It is a marginal edge. It is real. And if you're focused on it and focused on it exclusively, you are effectively tolerating the mediocrity of your favorite team. Like, really what you're doing is saying, well, my team couldn't possibly make a series 5 years worth of smart, disciplined maneuvers. They couldn't possibly behave with that level of resources and that level of ingenuity. And, you know, they couldn't build that big a front office, that innovative an approach to player selection. You know, they wouldn't have the stones to fire a coach after winning the President's Trophy because they disappointed in the playoffs. And they wouldn't have the stones to, after doing that, hire a coach whose profile was at a low ebb, despite them having been a previous Stanley Cup winner. You know, I mean, well, I guess Maurice wasn't the Stanley Cup winner in Carolina. Nonetheless, you know, there's a lot that's gone into this, and it's wildly impressive from this Panthers team, and that should be the focus, not the natural advantages of the teams based in no tax state locales, which matters, but much less than the amount of time it's occupying in the hockey conversation over the past couple months.
By the way, you said this is a while back now, but that the Canadian Stanley Cup team drought is now legal drinking age in the States. And my first thought was like, well, you know, that's 22 years. So he's off by a year. It would have been last year. And then a bunch of people texted and I was like, wait a second. 1993 is 32 years ago, not 22 years ago, as I initially thought when you said it. So that's the us being super old moment of the day. I was like, yeah, 22 years. Yeah, of course. Of course that's how long ago 1993 is.
I don't remember 93. Like, I don't remember the Habs winning the Stanley. I don't remember Desjardins. Like, I don't remember that.
I don't remember the Habs winning the Stanley Cup. I remember Joe Carter and the Blue Jays winning the World Series. That's like one of my earliest sports memories. But yeah, I don't remember the 1993 Stanley Cup. I remember everything from 90.
Disappointment of 94.
Yeah, everything from 94 on.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
not 1993. That's where it starts.
I'm bald. My beard is gray. I've never seen it.
Never seen what? Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. You know? Memory of it. Yeah.
None. You have kids. You have no memory of it.
I have like, not like babies, like, no, like school age kids.
Yeah. You're a pillar of the community.
That's true. I'm always telling people that. before we go to break here, when we were getting you connected at the start of the show, I was saying like the conversation that is most interesting to me is not, well, certainly not the state tax thing or, you know, dynasty or anything like that, but it's just stacking Florida up with the best. I mean, really like the best champions, however long you want to go back. I think it probably makes the most sense to go in the cap era. And for me, it comes down to, if we're talking about just dominant multi-year stretches, it comes down to them in Chicago. I'm not necessarily willing or ready right now to pick a winner there, but I think those are the two teams that I would have a cut above everyone else in the cap era. Is that where do you land on that take?
Yeah, it's them or Pittsburgh.
Okay.
I thought that Pittsburgh team was pretty impressive. The back-to-back Pittsburgh team with, you know, Kessel on the third line. And the reason I'd put them there is they had the same sort of similar vibe where it was like they can plug in anyone on defense because their forwards are so overpowered. You know what I mean? Like, you look back at that sort of 2018 Pittsburgh Penguins lineup, and the amount of sort of top-end forwards that we now understand that they had, right, is just preposterous. I mean, we're talking about, you know, we're talking 2016-17, right?
Yeah.
We're talking about Hornqvist, who was a monster, a horse, Malkin and Crosby, Kessel, Gensel, Chris Kunitz, Brian Rust, Patrick Hornqvist, Nick Bonino, and then, you know, guys like Sheary and Hagelin and company, right? I mean, that's the sort of thing that we're talking about. I do think that 2010 version of the Blackhawks, the Blackhawks that weren't able to be kept together.
Yes.
I think that's the other sort of contender here in my mind, because that was a team that likewise, you know, Taves, Kane, Sharp, Boland, Bufflin, Hossa, Versteeg, Brouwer, Andrew Ladd. I mean, that's you're going 8-9 deep with guys that almost immediately, because it got tested, like moved on after that season. And, you know, they win that Stanley Cup and Dustin Bufflin's like an X factor bottom six winger, right? At the time of the Cup win. And the very next season, he's a 50-point defenseman.
Yes.
Right? The very next season, Andrew Ladd is a 60-point winger with 29 goals and a unique physical profile. And, you know, they keep Boland for a little bit longer. But once he finally moves on, you know, he's a point-per-game center for the Toronto Maple Leafs before Zach Cassian injures him in that collision. You know, even Versteeg had like 40 points in 55 games for the Maple Leafs the very next season, right? So all of those guys immediately demonstrated that they were totally capable at the top end of the lineup, and they were like bit players for that Blackhawks team. So, you know, to what extent, though, do we remember it because of what those players did next in a way that we're not going to get the chance to with guys like Lustarainen and Lundell? It's not like it's going to be proven immediately. So I wonder if that sort of circumstance where all of the Blackhawks bit players became stars literally the next year, you know, sort of changes how we view that team in a way that the Panthers aren't going to get an opportunity to have happen to them. I will say this.
I do just think,
I don't
also
think anyone's ever been better defensively.
The top end of Kane, Taves, Sharp, Hossa, and then Keith and Seabrook on the blue line, like that might be the closest for me, like top six to what we've seen from Florida. If you just take like the six best skaters they have, you know what I mean? Like that is, sure. and those were guys who stuck around and did it in all three cups. Like that's just an absolute embarrassment of riches, similar to what Florida has when you list off the guys and you're like, yeah, Sam Bennett's like their fourth best forward.
Oh yeah.
Right?
Sam Bennett doesn't make their top line. It's Reinhardt, Tkachuk, Barkov, Forsling, and you pick one of Jones or Ekblad.
Yeah, exactly. It's absolutely outrageous.
All right. It is insane.
650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. A lot of people texting in about Tampa Bay, going back to the 08 Wings, the 07 Ducks. I'm not trying to disrespect any Stanley Cup champions. I'm just trying to narrow it down to the top two, and that's who I would have. But yes, there have been a lot of other fantastic Stanley Cup champions in the Cap era. We will take a break. Keep sending those texts in. We got to talk about the other big game from last night, which is, of course, the Abbotsford Canucks with a resounding win over the Charlotte Checkers. We'll get into that. And, of course, it's also the official start of the NHL off season, so lots to dive into there as well. Next on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Strantz. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. If you're just joining us, as I said off the top of the show, a little bit of a schedule change from a normal Wednesday. We're going to do the crossover tomorrow at the request of Donnie and Dolly. Happy to oblige. And we only have a couple of crossovers left. So we'll do the one tomorrow. Then we'll do one next week and the following week. And that'll be it for the crossover for this year. So want to make sure we can squeeze every edition in of that we can. Jason Buchla will join us at 1:30 today. So a little bit later on in the show. As I mentioned, so when we spent the whole first segment obviously digesting the back-to-back Stanley Cup victories from the Florida Panthers, resounding, comfortable win in Game 6 to get it done against the Edmonton Oilers. And the other big game, of course, that fans here were monitoring, and a lot of them were in attendance for last night, the Abbotsford Canucks score 5 times in the third period to take a 6-1 win over Charlotte in Game 3 of the Calder Cup Finals. They lead 2-1 now. Game 4 is Thursday in Abbotsford. Game 5 is Saturday in Abbotsford. And as a reminder, we're doing pre-game and post-game coverage for both of those games here on the station with Sat and Dan on site doing a post-game show afterwards. So lots of coverage. And all of a sudden, I mean, there's a chance if they win 2 in a row that they can claim the Calder Cup on their home ice in front of the Abbotsford faithful. And again, 5-goal explosion last night in the third period. Arshdeep Baines, 4 points, 2 goals, 2 assists. Linus Karlsson, 1 goal and 3 assists. Archer Shelov's made 28 saves. But I do think the takeaway for people in the building, for people watching from that game, was the Baines-Karlsson-Sasson line and what they were able to do breaking that game open in the third period.
Yeah, and it's becoming something of a signature or a trademark, right? Especially on home ice, running roughshod over opponents. In the third period, they did it to close out the Eastern Conference Championship in the American League, and obviously did it last night, just exploding all over the Charlotte Checkers. I mean, a true nuke show from Max Sisson and Arshdeep Baines with the 2 goals in that period. Really cool. I mean, they'd looked a little bit overmatched and fortunate on the road, and I think the way that those games looked and went, and how different yesterday was in terms of, you know, Abbotsford sort of wearing them down and becoming inevitable as that third period went on. I think that tells you actually that the stakes are pretty high here for the Canucks to, you know, win this fourth game, right? To stretch their advantage to try and avoid playing the decisive game of this series on the road. Clearly, with the matchup game and on, things shift really significantly in terms of the environment on the ice and the flow of these games based on where home ice is, which also, by the way, probably says a fair bit about Manny Malhotra, right?
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, that's the other part of this that I just want to note, right? Wednesday, it's 12:39 p.m. Pacific time, and the Dallas Stars still haven't named a head coach. So we're through my second benchmark, or we're not through it yet, but we're, you know, 5 p.m. today. We will be through it, and then I think this starts to become a situation that we'll be monitoring with a different level of urgency. But yeah, huge opportunity ahead here for the Abbotsford Canucks, and what a tremendous third period that was.
Yeah, it absolutely was, and I do think, and I know you've made the point that you know, it's kind of a fool's errand to try to pick the breakout star, but when you see that line specifically, and it's got probably 3 of the guys we would throw into that category of potential breakouts down the road who could really matter at the NHL level from this Calder Cup run. And when they're getting it done as a unit consistently, and especially, like, I really think there's something to be said for stepping up like that with that dominant a period in the biggest game of the year. It was the biggest game of the year. Tied game, your first game at home, or sorry, tied series, tied game, your first game at home in the series, and to step up and show up like that. Like, I think you're starting to able to zoom in on that trio a little bit, at least, and wonder, okay, who's it going to be? What are they going to look like next year? What are they going to look like the year after that? And I don't want to discount certainly Kirill Kurdyavsev or Victor Mancini or, you know, Archer Shelov's in goal, because those guys have all been instrumental as well. But the consistency of the big moments and big performances from that trio specifically is definitely catching my notice.
Yeah, I think the Canucks feel similarly, and they should. This has been wildly impressive from that sort of cohort. And I think, yeah, the fool's errand thing, the thing I've been talking about sort of what the history with American League, like successful American League teams and what it all means. I think the real lesson, Jamie, more than it's a fool's errand, is just that there can be, for those guys whom it's difficult to parse, are primarily responsible for this, there's more upside than we think, right? That we often talk about it as if, you know, well, that guy is this. And that's because that's the box that we've used to talk about them in the past, right? The idea that Yeah, like Archdeep Bane's kind of a low upside piece or what have you. But I do think that's more than anything what we should be open-minded about, right? That while I don't know which guy it is, and I wouldn't confidently assert that I do or that I could know which guy it is, you know, the one that it is, the guys that hit from this run can hit bigger than we imagine. And I think that's the real meat of that sort of take.
Right. Yeah, that there's generalized more upside. And I will say to the, you know, the other way we've framed it is kind of like, don't necessarily sell high on these guys as much as you want to keep them around in the organization. And I look at, let's say, Baines, Sasson, Carlson, and I'll throw Kudryavtsev in here. Like, what would selling high even mean? It's not like all of a sudden they've become these incredible trade chips. You know what I mean? So, like, in some ways, it's pretty easy to bet on keeping them around in the organization. Now, I think Mancini and Shelov's maybe in a little bit of a different boat there, where they might actually have some tangible value, but you have to at least think about moving. But for those other guys, like, again, I don't think all of a sudden they've launched them. They've completely changed what other people around the industry will be thinking. So I think that makes it all the easier to say, you know what? Like, we're just going to keep these guys. They're good organizational hands. They all played NHL games for us this year. We know we're going to need the depth, and then maybe one of them pops. Like, I think that is a lot more enticing than whatever still relatively minimal trade value I think they would have out there.
Yeah, and there's also the aspect of managing, you know, the sort of waiver exemption part of this too, right? That's going to be something to look at. Like with
sure.
Artur Shelov's, whether his value spikes as a result of this or not, part of what the club is going to have to be strongly considering is going to be, you know, can we expose a guy like this on waivers, given that, you know, there's a variety of teams that could use some help in goal. Edmonton, that, you know, maybe would hazard that claim, that would take a look at them at the NHL level if the Canucks don't set themselves up to do so themselves or don't monetize him well ahead of time. You know, Baines requires waivers this fall. Carlson requires waivers this fall. So partly, too, what they've done with this run and with these level of performances, and as the stage gets bigger and as, you know, more scouts and more American League people and assistant general managers who run American League teams but also have, you know, a voice in their NHL teams, hockey operations, decision-making, you know, they have more exposure. They have more surface area in terms of eyeballs from those types of people who can give them an NHL opportunity. In addition to maybe having a leg up to make this team in the fall. If they don't, they're also, you know, somewhat more likely, 5%, 10%, to get claimed off of waivers and have an opportunity to have one of those good Jonah Gadjevich glow-ups, right? Where you get to be a full-time NHL-level player, potentially on a really good team. So, yeah, I mean, that's sort of part of this too, right? You have to consider, I think, in the sell-high equation, you know, is this guy going to make our team credibly? He might not have sell high value, but should we manage the value?
Should we at least at least get something rather than lose him for nothing?
Right.
Yeah.
And in my view, anyway, what I would be conscious of if I'm the Canucks, without minimizing this team's needs up front, right? Because they're so significant.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd certainly keep my powder dry or leave some spots open for a surprise or two. Right. It's why, you know, when I think about what this Canucks team needs, right, it's like a wash of high end talent up front.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking multiple top line caliber players, one of whom is a star. And then we're talking about replacing Suter and Besser. It's not like you replace Suter and Besser and it's like, well, we added two forwards. It's like, no. You need to add two forwards and then credibly replace those guys,
mm-hmm.
right? So there's a lot of work to do up front. I don't want to understate that, especially if we're, you know, setting the bar at compete with Florida and Edmonton level teams, right? Did Edmonton even, right? Like, the Edmonton didn't even jump over the bar at the end of the race. So it's an incredibly high bar that we're judging teams against, or we're judging the Canucks against, but that's how it should be. This is pro sports, and our listeners want to follow a team that's got a shot.
Yeah.
Right? We don't want to just do the hope thing the hope thing that Vancouver's gotten so good at, sort of living in and accepting and tolerating, frankly, since 2000, what, 12, 13, mm-hmm. something like that. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of needs that this club has, but, you know, I think there's a world where you can still pursue that end while leaving space for guys like Baines and Carlson and Ratu, right? And even creating that space if you need to with various trades or other things, right? I mean, someone in our inbox said, you know, how would Kiefer Sherwood be being talked about if he was on the Florida Panthers, mm-hmm. right? And it's a interesting formulation given how, you know, Sherwood's got some dog in him, right? That sort of style of play would seem to fit to some extent, even if Sherwood's slighter of frame than your typical Florida Panthers winger. But, you know, he's got the skill. He's good shooter, had a great first season in Vancouver. Honest effort every night, which we'll take given what we watched in some of those mid-November and mid-December yep. and mid-January games from this group. But yeah, the truth is like whether it's guys like Sherwood or Bluger or not committing to guys like Suter or not committing to guys like Brock Besser, if you think you need, you know, faster guys or guys that are a better fit, or realistically, guys you think are more credible at the top of the lineup, like that's fine because we're talking about different buckets, right? We're talking about different yes. varieties of players entirely. Like, I don't think you should be too attached to, you know, some of the guys that Vancouver has, even a Nils Höglander, who would have more value, because what this team needs to bring in is significantly higher end, right? And I don't think bringing those guys in is like in conflict with the idea of creating space and giving your Ratu, Baines, Sasson tier dudes a real look at camp next season and leaving space on the roster for them to make it and like play a big role for you.
Well, and this texter said along these lines, right, gents, maybe this AHL run will allow them to sell on some of their NHL players, for example, Kiefer Sherwood, right? Because you're looking, okay, like, and I do think that's
the
play.
Now you interest me.
I think that's now the play is where it's let's bet in bulk on these guys from the AHL to like really fill out our fourth line in a really cost-effective yes. way, but also with some upside. So we're not going out and investing in our fourth line. And in fact, we can move some bottom six pieces because we're going to, and it's all, it's just like a different way of trying to capture upside, right? Whether, you know, you get in some assets from moving some of your bottom six pieces, you open up just a little bit of cap space, but you also maybe tap into some greater upside from the AHL guys that you're counting on to do that job. And there's risk there because maybe they're not able to give you, you know, like 80% of Kiefer Sherwood or whatever you're expecting to get out of them. But I just think it's another way of viewing how they approach this offseason through the lens of what's the ultimate upside play. Like, how can we approach even how we build our fourth line? How can we approach that from the point of view of maximizing the potential upside? And I do think that's probably, at the very least, it's something you start to consider, right? Something that you have to be willing to play with. And I will say, and you know, we'll talk more about kind of general offseason stuff and the Canucks offseason approach in the next segment. But one of the themes that's quickly developing around the NHL is just like the dearth of supply of good players to meet the demand. Like every team, with the possible exception of the Pittsburgh Penguins, is motivated to get better, motivated to acquire players, not interested in selling. You know, every guy, it's like, well, yeah, he might be available, but we need a just as good a player back, right? We're not going to make our team worse.
No one wants to be Chicago or San Jose.
Yeah.
And that fear is freezing the market.
Yes. And so in that environment, you know, I'm not saying all of a sudden they're going to go for hauls, but if you have guys who are just like legitimate, no doubt about it, NHL players, right? Like a Nils Höglander, like a Dakota Joshua, got a little bit of term, right? You can see it, recent 20 goal seasons under their belts, all of those things. Do teams have to start looking in that area or in that kind of bin rather than the, well, we're just going to go out and get like a high end top six center, right? Because everyone's bidding on those guys and no one wants to give them up.
Yeah, and I think this is where the discussion comes back to, I mean, square this for me, Jamie. Mm-hmm. Square this for me. No one wants to sell. Everyone wants good players back or active players back, right? there's not enough supply of good players. The market for Marco Rossi is cool.
Yes. Okay. This is
square this for me. Everyone, there are no sellers.
Yeah.
Everyone wants useful players back. There's very little market for Trevor Zegras.
Yeah. Well, I actually do think you can square both of those things, which is that at this time of year, having just watched Florida win their back-to-back Stanley Cups, that teams are obsessed with the size and dog thing, right? Like,
yeah, well, they should be,
which is fair. But like, isn't that how you square it, or at least come as close to squaring it as possible?
100%. But I mean, you don't usually become the most efficient team, especially from a position like the Canucks occupy, right, where you're, you know, asset poor everywhere that counts. Right. I mean, they don't have a cap crunch, but they don't have buying power relative to, you know, most teams in the league. They're certainly not positioned like a Columbus or one of those teams with, you know, 20 million, 30 million, 40 million in some cases worth of cap space. Right. Like this is what we're talking about here. They have less cap space than the Florida Panthers. They have less cap space than the Carolina Hurricanes. Right. I mean, their buying power in relative terms is, you know, compromised is too harsh a term, but below average. They're below average buying power. They haven't done the work to set themselves up to be in the driver's seat in any of these talks. So it's not like they're already, you know, at the front of the line in terms of being able to outbid a Montreal or a Columbus or an Anaheim in whatever opportunity comes up, right? And I think that's the other, just to come back to some of the like lessons of the Panthers, and it being like every single opportunity, those real weird, real world ones that just crop up on occasion, they were like at the front of the line. It's like the Calgary Flames are rebuilding dramatically in the wreckage as they sift through the wreckage of the Daryl Sutter era. And it's like, oh, they have Bennett and Tkachuk, right? And it's like the Buffalo Sabres dismantling the Eichel and Reinhardt. And it's like, oh, yeah, they got one of those guys, right? The pandemic hits and no one can spend. And they're the team that's making waiver claims and signing Duclair and signing Wenberg and signing Verhaeghe. Like, do you remember that offseason, which happened in the fall? It was like the Canucks don't have the budget to sign Travis Hamonic.
Yep.
And Panthers were just like going out and claiming guys. You know, like betting in bulk on 7-8 guys, Lomberg and Hinostroza and on and on. Every single weird opportunity that has come up, it feels like they've been at the front of the line. Oh, the Chicago, the Seth Jones one this year, where Seth Jones starts openly criticizing the organization and agitating for a deal. Well, guess where he lands? It's incredible the extent to which this is just the product of repeated opportunism. And it's like for the Canucks, we're in the opposite conversation always, right? It was like the pandemic hits and they're one of the teams that is most, you know, sort of hit by budget constraints, right? They're the team that shaved the most relative salary year over year. You know, and then you have sort of the Olive Reckman Larson thing and, you know, they're the team. They spend all this time positioning themselves to have the flexibility to add big at the deadline. And what, you know, and it's just like, which star player is going to randomly shake loose? Well, it was JT Miller.
Yeah.
It's just like, no, this team is always on that sort of, the opportunity hits the other way. And so now we're in this cap growth era where instead of it being all about, oh, right, sorry, the way the Oliver Ekman-Larsson trade fits into this is the flat cap hits and all of a sudden the weight of the, like the Roussel, Beagle, Erickson, too much term and money to depth players becomes like completely unwieldy, right? And the Canucks overpay to get out of what would have, you know, frankly inhibited them. I mean, it did anyway, but truly inhibited them from having even a shot on paper of bouncing back after being seventh in the All-Canadian division, right? So it's just like now we're going into this cap growth era where it's all going to be about talent accumulation, and part of doing that well is having enough talent and having players want to play for you And Florida's set up to run with that. Value, guys wanting to play there. Matthew Tkachuk literally recruiting, even as he's lighting a victory cigar after winning the latest Stanley Cup final.
Well, and how about, you want to talk about a recruitment ad, giving Nate Schmidt the Stanley Cup. Like, are you kidding me? If you're a veteran who hasn't won a Stanley Cup before, and like you see that, and it's like, I'm going to walk in and I'm going to be their guy instantly. They will treat me like I'm one of the guys. Like, it was from the second I step into that room, even though they've already won Stanley Cups. Like, man, if you're on the fence about where to sign, I can't imagine a better recruitment pitch than that display from them.
In fact, they're going to commit to trying to do it again to win one for me.
For me, yeah. And like, I think it was Verhaeghe who was like, you know, I almost was happier watching those guys lift it than I was about lifting it myself, right? Because they hadn't done it before and I was just so happy for them. It's like, that's a wild thing to say. And I don't mean like wild wrong. It's just like wildly impressive and revealing about the culture that they've built there and why guys would want to play there.
I hate it so much. But yeah, I mean, there's a risk here, Jamie, that the teams that are able to make these pitches and accumulate this talent, especially over the next 3 years with the cap going up by $7-8 million per year, are going to gain a durable advantage that's going to take years to whittle away if you end up on the sort of elevator that's going down, right, at this specific moment. I think that's partly why no one wants to sell either. No one wants to be Chicago. No one wants to be San Jose. These elevators are going in opposite directions, and it's going to be the Vegases and the Floridas and the Dallases that are going to land all these top guys. And that's a really scary proposition, because all of a sudden, in a league where parity is dying, the mushy middle becomes, you know, even more, not just entrenched, not just stickier, but like more pathetic.
Yeah, harder to get out of, for sure. All right, we'll take a break. I do want to double back on the Marco Rossi conversation, because I think you made a good point. There's another layer also, which another layer to it also, which I think falls into the like square this one for me rubric that I want to dive into. And we can start just to kind of map out the offseason, right? Because we're into that time now. You know, we know when the buyout window is going to open. There's nothing necessarily holding up trades, or not a lot holding up trades at this point. So we can dive into the offseason. Send your text in 650-650. And we'll get into all of that. As a reminder, Jason Buchla is going to join us at 1:30 here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd, Thomas Trance. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, and we've talked Stanley Cup, we've talked Calder Cup, and of course it is now officially the NHL offseason, and we're starting to get, you know, that steady drumbeat of rumors, who might be available, which teams are calling, and all of that. I know, you know, Frank Saravalli was on with Halfden Bruff this morning. He said the Canucks have certainly checked in, or he believes the Canucks have checked in with Buffalo on J.J. Paterka. I do want to start with the Marco Rossi conversation here. I know this is a player we've dealt with a lot. We've spent a lot of time on. But, you know, you were making the point, like, it doesn't entirely make sense the degree to which, on the one hand, we're hearing so many teams are desperate to upgrade, there's so few quality players available, but on the other hand, we're hearing people aren't really that interested in Marco Rossi. And I get it. 5'9" center, it's a tough bet to make that he's going to be a long-term fixture in your top six. The other part of this, though, that I find interesting is, and I know it was Elliot Friedman on his 32 Thoughts podcast that dropped today, saying that, you know, Minnesota's out there making it known, like, hey, we don't want to get worse in a Marco Rossi trade, right? And that's another theme you've heard in a lot of these deals. Same thing with Buffalo, with J.J. Paterka, right? Like, hey, we're not interested in futures. We want to get better, so we might trade the guy, but we need equivalent value back. But from Minnesota's perspective, like, I get it with Buffalo and J.J. Paterka, right? That's not being driven by the team. They like the player. Presumably, they would be happy to get him to a long-term extension and, you know, for him to continue to figure in their plans and their top six going forward. But for Minnesota and Rossi, it's like you guys are the ones who announced to the league that you're not high on the player through your actions, right? Much more clearly than you possibly could have through words. You showed everyone in the playoffs what you think of this player and specifically what you don't think he's capable of. And you said, again, explicitly through your actions that you see him as a fourth line center in the playoffs. So it's great to say, like, well, we don't want to get worse, but my next follow-up is question, well, in Minnesota's mind, what does that even mean? Like, if they're not that high on the player, then you should be able to deal him relatively easily without getting worse in your minds. And I think just the more I think about the general skepticism around the league on Marco Rossi, right, the position that Minnesota finds itself in where it's just
they've created,
and it's just so hard to see a road forward for them and Rossi. As much as it's like, well, you know, hey, well, we'd be happy to keep him and play him third line center, or it just really feels like that bridge is burned. And you add it all up, and if other teams, like, let's take Montreal for example, a team that it's been reported and, you know, makes sense that they want to go get a second line center. Well, if you're Montreal, you know, you've already got Cole Caulfield, you've got Nick Suzuki. I understand not wanting to make a big bet on Marco Rossi as your second line center for the future, right? You've also probably got a little more patience, more assets to win the bidding on somebody who has less question marks. Like, I completely understand from Montreal's perspective saying, you know what, Marco Rossi, that's not where we're going to keep our powder dry. We're going to see what shakes loose and we're going to wait for a better fit. I don't know if the Canucks have that luxury of patience. And if all the other teams that are looking for second line centers are saying, you know what, we're going to wait, we're going to pass on Marco Rossi, and it's not really a situation where there's a plausible path forward for Minnesota and the player. Like, I don't know how it's not priority number one at this point. Just judging the situation from what we know publicly, it seems like far and away the situation that checks both the fit for the Canucks box best and also the can we realistically acquire him box best, given what we're hearing about the market for the player.
Yeah, I also think we should be conscious of remembering that outside of, I mean, Barkov and Noshik are big guys, but Lundell and Bennett are like 6-footers.
Yep.
They're not 6'4".
Nope.
They play like it.
They've got the mentality. This is what I've been saying. Yeah. It's so much more about the dog factor than it is about size.
Yeah. There's big players who don't play big, don't use their size well. Right. There are smaller players who are absolute dogs. And Marco Rossi's a dog who scores goals in dirty areas of the ice. You know, look, it's not perfect. He's got a unique profile. I don't think the fit concerns are invalid by any means. And I would never say otherwise. But given the opportunity we're talking about, like, let's contrast it with J.J. Paterka, who does not have any of the same, like, Milos against him, right?
Okay.
Guy doesn't work defensively.
Yeah.
I don't know. That seems like a problem to me.
He's also, he's not a center. Like, that's a massive one. You know what I mean?
Also not a center.
That's a massive one as far as the Canucks are concerned here.
Yeah, give me the dog. Give me the dog who plays a premium spot. And, you know, he played in the fourth line in the playoffs. Like, he can't hack it. It's like, well, they made that decision.
Yep.
And he still scored 2 goals.
Yep.
He still produced. So, yeah, I mean, for me, I just think this is such an interesting time of year where, you know, fans in discussing the team, they don't want to give up anything good. They don't want to pay good players enough.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, Sam Bennett, 12 times 7. That would be a gift for the Canucks.
Yeah.
Like, that would be a gift. It's not going to happen. But if the Canucks had the chance to land Sam Bennett for $12 million a year, you shouldn't even blink about it. You shouldn't even think about it. It's like, yes, absolutely. Thank God. Thank you for choosing us. What a huge game changer for our franchise.
Yeah. Look, if that player's... If that
did
player,
I make you uncomfortable? Did I go too far?
It does. Like, I do. I absolutely think there's risk there, but I also think you do it. Like, if that player chooses your franchise, given the way he figures in the like hierarchy of the NHL right now, he's the reigning Conn Smythe winner. You know what I mean? Like he's an international champion for Canada, and he's the reigning Conn Smythe winner. And the salary cap is going up a lot in the near future. I do kind of think like, yeah, I'm not saying I think I'm a little less bullish on it than you are, because I do think there's legitimate risk there, especially with Sam Bennett's scoring profile in the regular season. But I think the intangible stuff and just like the shot in the arm it would give this franchise to have that player affirmatively choose to be here and be part of the solution, I think that would all be worth paying for, even if it gets to an outlandish price like that.
100%. Again, the game is simple. Accumulate talent. Mm-hmm. Do not fall behind. Accumulate talent, as much of it as you can. Enough teams are going to have cap space. You're going to be able to solve your problems. And you know what's a lock? November 15th is going to hit. You're going to be a week out from American Thanksgiving, and 6 to 10 teams around the league are going to be thirsty to change up their mix because it's not going the way they'd hoped.
Mm-hmm.
Lock. Right? And so what does that mean? That means there is opportunity to make trades. There's going to be opportunities to solve problems. We're going into a more forgiving environment, right? Where it's not like every mistake is something you're stuck with forever and that's got the ability to just kill your chances to contend or compete, right? Like you're going to be able to work around with a greater degree of flexibility than you had during the flat cap era some of these issues, right? And so, you know, that changes sort of where your priorities should be. But your priority should be absolutely just land the best possible players you can and then try to figure it out. Because we're entering this world where instead of having this conversation where it's like, is this guy a value? Is this an efficient contract? Is the team using their resources the right way? And that being the central question that's making the difference between winning teams and losing teams, we're going to get to have the conversation of, is that player good? Does that player help this team win? Does the way this team is built help them win games? And that's so much healthier a place for the sport to be, mm-hmm. and so much more fun. But wrapping our head around it, given what we've endured, the like relentless austerity that the NHL game was kind of guided by and shaped by across the last 5 years is going to, you know, there's going to be some whiplash as we adjust.
Johnny from Langley texts in, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Canucks should be patient and not try and stuff square pegs into round holes. Does Florida not show that situations change and players shake free from other teams? I would rather us hold our assets and find the right fits at the right time, not making a trade or signing players because we have to. I think there's a lot of wisdom to that approach that Johnny from Langley outlines there, right? That generally, yeah, don't sign a guy just because you feel like, well, we got to do something and, you know, we've got this need, so let's take the best available option. It's just when you think about the circumstances that the Canucks are in specifically, they've made it so clear that they want to do this upgrade, that they want to go in to next season with a different forward group. I also think it's different when, you know, if you're looking at like, hey, we really like our forward group, but we need an upgrade on second line center. Okay, so that's one player you're talking about. I think it's a lot easier to keep your powder dry in that situation than when you find yourself in the circumstances of the Canucks and you're thinking like, we need a second line center, we'd love to get another center, and we probably need like two wingers on top of that as well. And at that stage, it's like, okay, you can wait for player X to shake loose, but that's still only one guy. You know what I mean? Like you almost have to do some of the work in the near term. Then maybe you can get around to seeing who shakes loose in November and December and January. But if you're waiting for all of those pieces because you can't find the right fit, like you're just not going to be able to do all of that work in season. And again, on the Rossi thing, like I think you can plausibly go acquire Rossi, sign him to a contract, and still have a fair amount of assets left to wait around for that player to shake loose, right? Like, mm-hmm. what are we talking about for a Rossi price at this point? 15th overall. And I should also mention Frank Saravalli said, like, yeah, they'd probably be willing to take futures and try to flip it for something else. So 15th overall, but plus what? Like, not Tom Bolander.
No.
No?
I mean, we did the old, you know, exercise looking at what the 15th overall can buy the Canucks a little while ago, right? And most of those deals included more than a first. So I would say like Mancini and a first, right? That becomes kind of like the Brock Faber and 20th overall for Kevin Fiala trade that the Wild made a few years ago, and that's this general manager.
Yeah. Yeah. So
that like, to me is like the range.
Yeah. And so like, okay, that's not a, that's not, I wouldn't say that's like a bargain price or anything, but that's not, you've spent all of your money now in one spot. You know what I mean? You still have assets you can do things with if the right player becomes available at some point in the season. So, cause part of the stumbling block for me thinking about how this Canucks season or off season is going to unfold is like, how do you get to high level acquisitions done considering what it's going to cost to get them done. And with Rossi, I can see the path towards doing Rossi and another significant transaction at some point, either in the off season or in the early to mid part of next season.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for sure. It's not going to be sufficient, you know, and that's, but I think also when you look at it and think about it and think about this team's significant needs, right? You ideally want a center. Ideally, you want two.
Mm-hmm.
But more than anything, you want guys with a chance to be a star or a top liner, like a real first line player. And I just think Rossi certainly checks the first liner box in a way that, you know, and I guess that's why Peterka doesn't have the same question marks around him, because he has the star potential, right? That upside is what you'd be chasing. Plus the mold of, go after defensively inconsistent Buffalo Sabres player and he might be a lot better than you think, has paid dividends. You know, with both Jack Eichel and Reinhardt being top five in Selke voting after years of playing for a permissive version of the Buffalo Sabres, right? So, but yeah, more than positional need, more than anything, that upside is what I think this Canucks team has to chase. And Rossi at least hits the lower of the two. Right, when I sort of sketch out this team's needs and think to myself, star player, like transcendent star player, but you're not going to land when they are that. So you have to land the guy who has a shot to be that, right? Credible first line player. Again, you're not probably going to be able to acquire that. Not
the established one. Yeah.
Yeah. But the guy with a shot to be that. And then we're talking Besser and Suter replacements, which is still like second line caliber guys. Right? I mean, really good players. So, yeah, I mean, the bets, like, if you're going to land two or three of these guys, the bets are not going to be perfect. And the truth is that if you're going to be able to sort of put together multiple outs for yourself, right, it's probably going to be incumbent on you to almost, like, gamble with sort of the smellier assets. Like, the uglier it is, the worse it looks on paper, means the less it costs you.
Well, it
means the more of those bets you can
place.
That's
the thing. It gives you more swings. That's a huge part of it. It gives you more swings at the plate rather than just putting all of your eggs in one basket. And I think that is part of the attraction to me at this point with Marco Rossi. It's like, if the rest of the league is going to turn up their nose at him because of the fit concerns and because of the size concerns, you kind of got to. And that's driving the price down. Like, I think you have to be willing to explore that at this point. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Now, Andrew and Langley says, I'm less concerned about acquiring Rossi. What I am concerned is having four guys on the roster, Hughes, Hoglander, Garland, and Rossi, all 5'10 or less, when the playoffs emphasize size and grit. I can understand that. I can understand the, like, worry about the cumulative effect of having, you know, more smaller players on the team, as opposed to if you're dropping, like, one guy in a lineup that is already, you know, kind of built for that playoff hockey. I do like our idea that we pitched, I think, last week of the Rossi Garland Hoglander line. So the containment unit for the small players on the team, and just have all your big guys elsewhere and have all the small players on the same line. But okay, I can understand that concern. But again, this is where I think you have to be willing to be creative. Like, can you move Hoglander and or Garland for other pieces that help you, right? To remake the composition of your four groups so that's less of a concern. Or is that something you just punt and try to figure out down the road? Because I don't think anyone's expecting the Canucks to come out of, you know, the next few weeks here and all of a sudden have a clear-cut, no doubt about it, Stanley Cup caliber forward group, right? What you're looking to do is get the building blocks in, and in an ideal world, then you can do the final touches down the road. But you're like, there's going to be some pieces, ah, that's not quite the perfect fit, or oh, I'm not sure if that guy can handle that role. You're going to have to be willing to take those bets and put the finishing touches on it later. It's not going to be a finished product, you know, when we sit here talking to wrap up our show on July 4th.
No, I think that's true, and I think that's fair. The truth, too, is that that's how this Canucks team looks at it. It's easy to forget because this past season things went so badly that they weren't able to capitalize off of the position that they built for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But we saw this team in 2023-24, you know, upgrade their defense corps significantly as the season went along and actively in the Beauvillier trade and the Zadorov trade and then the Lindholm trade, right? They really do organizationally view the start of the season more like the starting gates, right? With the idea that they can change their team in mid-course. That's like a Rutherford staple. So really, you're just trying to build a good enough team to get off to a good start.
Yes.
And to help you evaluate what they need and whether they have a shot and what they need to get over that hump, as it were. And so, yeah, I think what you've just outlined there is exactly right.
Yeah, you're trying to kind of build a platform and then you see where you go from there. But no, like you should absolutely not expect to look at it and expect the finished product in a couple of weeks' time here or, you know, whenever they finish kind of doing their business. We did have someone text in, by the way, like, okay, this text comes in. If the Canucks management wants to fundamentally reimagine their forward group, do you anticipate most of their moves being made before or after July 1st? If before, do you anticipate the shoe dropping soon? Seems like a lot of work to do, and we're running out of days. I would expect a very busy 12 days here going into July 1st, right? You've got the draft in there. We'll see if anything happens before that. I know Abbotsford is still wrapping up, but I would expect a pretty jam-packed, I'm not just talking about Canucks here, but league-wide, I would expect a pretty significant amount of movement and transactions and action here over the next 12 days.
Likewise. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, it should be a blast. Jason Buchla is going to join us in the next segment. By the way, never too early to get your Vancouver Giants season's tickets. Tickets start at under $19 at vancouvergiants.com/season tickets. I also, of course, want to tell you about the Sportsnet 650 Jays Care 50-50, which is now live. You could win half the jackpot. The other half supports Challenger Baseball, a program that helps kids of all abilities across BC thrive through sport. Tickets start at just $10 with bundles for even more chances to win. Don't wait. Get your tickets now at jayscaregolf.rafflenexus.com or text money to 650-650 now to get the link sent directly to you. Now, I've been telling you all about how once we get the jackpot to $15,000, we're giving away a signed Quinn Hughes jersey. We've got another little bonus giveaway going on today, which is that if we can raise $1,000 today before the end of Canucks Central, we'll give away a 4-pack of tickets to the Canadiens game on July 1st, the Canada Day Nooner special. That's going to be a fantastic atmosphere at the Nat. So if we get it up to $1,000 extra before the end of Canucks Central today, we'll give away that 4-pack of tickets to Nat Bailey on July 1st for a Nooner. It's against the Seattle Mariners affiliate. So whether you're a Jays fan, whether you're a Mariners fan, there's some for everyone in this one to go see the Seas on July 1st on a Nooner at the Nat. Again, jayscaregolf.rafflenexus.com or text money to 650-650 right now and we'll send the link to you. Must be 19 or older and live in BC to play. Let's make a big impact together. Jason Buchla to wrap up the show next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650, Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz. We are broadcasting live from the Kintech studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. Guests on Sportsnet 650, call in on the hotline, powered by Power West Industries. Don't get caught in the dark when it matters most. Visit them at powerwest.ca today. They keep the lights on. Jason Buchla is going to join us momentarily here, of course, from Sportsnet and former director of amateur scouting in the NHL. And in fact, he is now ready. So, Books, thanks for doing this as always. How are you?
I'm doing great, fellas. How are you doing today?
We're doing well. And, you know, just taking the time to kind of digest and reflect on the display of dominance from the Florida Panthers, not just last night in clinching the Stanley Cup, but really, I mean, over the last 2-3 years, go back to when they first made the Stanley Cup final. What do you think will be your kind of lasting takeaway from this run that we've seen Florida go on over a several-year period now?
I think really my biggest takeaway from a team perspective is just the fact that they're so connected as a group, and they come at you in consistent waves of high-end compete, truculence, I guess we can use that word in there, skill, all of it. You know, they're a relentless group that you know, it's been fun to watch their evolution. Obviously, I have a little bit of a bias there, since I know so many people still around the team, and so does Drancer. And I'm happy for them. I really am. I'm really happy to see as well, because there's so much talk about core. And you know, I'm really happy to see that a lot of the core group there, the Barkovs, the Ekblads, I would even say Lundell's part of that now. And obviously Bobrovsky, you know, when he got signed as free agent, that went from being the worst contract in the league, according to a lot of people, to holy jumping, this guy's a no doubt Hall of Famer, to thank God we've got him between the pipes to win Stanley Cups.
On Sasha Barkov, because, you know, for so long, the running joke was he's perennially named the most underrated player in the NHL, to the point where it's like, okay, stop, he's not underrated anymore. But I do think there's still one aspect that maybe at least until this week of his, you know, everything he brings to the team might have been underrated, and that's his work as captain. And, you know, because I think we look at it, and like when Matthew Tkachuk got there, okay, he's kind of the emotional leader of the team. You know, he has such a big personality, plays with that swagger. You know, Paul Maurice is a big personality behind the bench, and sometimes what Barkov is doing flies a little bit under the radar. But you listen to all of them talk last night, and especially the new players, about the environment they were welcomed into when they joined the team. You watch him hand it off to Nate Schmidt first, because he's never won a Stanley Cup before. And I think we're really starting to appreciate, just not only is this guy a phenomenal player, but he's clearly done an incredible job as the captain of that team, leading that group.
I totally agree. He's a special human being. I think it just starts with that. You know, you can be between the whistles, you can be as elite as anybody in the league, offensively, certainly defensively. Like, don't make no mistake. Like, Sasha Barkov, he could score north of 100 points every year if he wanted to cheat the game a little bit more. But the fact of the matter is, he doesn't. And that's exactly the way he is off the ice as well. He doesn't cheat his teammates. And he's just a super, super human being. He's considerate, soft-spoken, lead by example, you know, just follow me kind of guy. I'll take you to where you want to go without having to talk about it too much. And by the way, I've got your back every step of the way as well. And, you know, Nate Schmidt getting that handed off to him last night, and them going through the whole line of, you know, even the Black Aces getting it before the guys that had already won it before, that just speaks to character and consideration. And that resonates within your locker room. And he's the yin to the yang to a lot of those players. Like, trust me when I tell you, like, Aaron Ekblad has got more alpha in him than Barkey ever will. And when Claude Giroux, I do believe that one of the turning points for Barkey from a leadership perspective was several years ago now, 3 years ago, when the Panthers traded for Claude Giroux to come in, who was obviously a longtime captain in Philly. Giroux, I think in reflection would say that it was a little bit of an adjustment for him not to be himself necessarily in the Panther dressing room, or not to step on people's toes. But I think also having another captain come in like that at a key moment in a trade, like, it evolved Barkey as well. And he's evolved a little bit without really changing his stripes. This is a special player, kind of like an Anze Kopitar in L.A. You know, they just, there's bred to be special people. No matter what that guy would have decided to do in life, whether it be a hockey player or, you know, flipping burgers at the local McDonald's, he would have been the best of whatever it was.
I'm going to make the argument that Sasha Barkov is still underrated, and here's my evidence.
Okay.
Voting point totals for the Conn Smythe, as voted on by the PHWA yesterday. Sam Bennett, 76 points. Brad Marchand, 68 points. Sergei Bobrovsky, 10 points. Leon Draisaitl, 7 points. Gustav Forsling got a vote. A third place vote, 1 point. I didn't read Sasha Barkov. And yet, isn't he the guy most responsible for setting the environment? Like, isn't he the guy that's gone up against McDavid in 120 minutes in back-to-back Stanley Cup finals and only surrendered 2 5-on-5 goals against? Two! What are we doing? He's still underrated.
No. I agree with you there. 100%. I chuckled only because he's not loud enough to answer to draw attention to himself. You know, he's just not. And it doesn't matter to him. And that's the beauty of it, isn't it? Like, the beauty of an athlete who's cut out of the cloth of Barkov is that it doesn't matter. However, the result matters. The interior, the inside of the room, you know, keeping the glue together, keeping everybody happy, keeping people, you know, in tow, if you will. That matters way more than some of the writers in the industry who don't have. that's juvenile to me. Like, I'm actually aggravated now that you brought it up, because you're bang on. Like, that's absolutely juvenile for them to look and see this guy play every key minute of every game for the last 3 years and three consecutive Stanley Cup playoff runs and do what he does and not have the type of recognition. That just tells me that people are blind fans of the game sometimes, instead of actual people who dig deep into the nuts and bolts of how the team game gets positive results, because that's what he's all about.
Lastly, you know, there's not a lot of players on this roster anymore that were drafted while you were, you know, the head of scouting, amateur scouting for the Florida Panthers, right? I mean, Barkov and Eck. Is that it?
Yep.
I think that's it, right?
We're going through this yesterday with some of my colleagues, our colleagues in the industry, and that's all that's left now. And they've traded out, and they have no draft capital. They traded out. I'm proud of the job that the Evan Marbles of the world, and you know Billy Ryan in Montreal, you know, obviously Aaron Janelle and Scott Luce before. I'm proud of the job that the entire staff did there to allow the Florida Panthers the flexibility to deal away grade A assets. And Dale Talon did a hell of a job keeping all of our draft capital. So what Bill Zito walked into and has done a magnificent job, by the way, of doing was selling off high-end assets that the other teams in the league wanted to acquire in their current state for their teams. The Tippetts, even the Mathesons, the Montembeaux, Huberto and Uyghur to Calgary. Spencer Knight is the last one. Like, I'll put it back on you guys. How important was the trade? And I'll give Seth Jones all the credit in the world, because I haven't been a huge fan in the past, and that's on me. That bias, I have to get over myself. As you know, Janser, better than anybody else, sometimes I got to get out of my own way. But the Spencer Knight trade was the last one, and if we don't make what I believe to be smart picks and accumulate assets within the organization, he doesn't have the flexibility to make the magnificent moves he made. So I'm not sitting here. It's not a Debbie Downer day for me and the guys that got fired or let go when we were all there, but I am proud of them, and I think I should be.
Yeah.
And I think that the Florida Panthers recognize, too, that they are left an embarrassment of riches to deal out the door and then left with that core group that put them over or took them over the top as well. So, yeah. You know, it's nice that way. That's reward. I am rewarded. I am rewarded. Internally a little bit. I don't get to wear the rock, but I do know this, that over the last 5 years since we have not been there, there hasn't been one drafted player that's been on the roster. Mackie Samoskovich would be a black ace for this year, and he's a really good player. Nobody's on their roster that they've drafted. So,
yeah, the sort of framing I wanted to shoot at you there, Books, was, you know, as in the job that you've done your whole career, you know, do you look at it as, hey, I contributed draft capital, even though you're obviously invested in the success of the players that you look into and study and get right. And in your case, you have been able to take a lot of pride in that, eh?
Absolutely take a lot of pride in that. That's yeah. when we can ream off half a roster that got traded out that are still good players elsewhere in the league. I'm absolutely proud of that. I don't want it to be about me. I want it to be about, you know, like Brian McCabe's still down there, Braden Birch, all the same guys, you know, Addy, like Addy, like, come on. Does anybody work harder than Addy?
No.
People that don't know, like Addy is the team, like she's the go-between for the players. What would you call her title? Director of Public Relations or what is
yeah,
that?
She's title? The yeah, she's the PR head. I don't know exactly what her title is anymore, but she reported to me when I was there and she rocked.
Yeah. You know, so I'm proud of what we left behind and how it turned into something great for everybody else. And I'm proud of the fact that some of my guys that got fired, who didn't deserve to be fired, by the way, and are doing fabulous jobs with other organizations, Evan Marble in Washington, for example. I'm proud of the fact that they can take a little bit of a piece of this too. And, you know, pat themselves on the back a bit. It's okay to do that.
Turning things around to the Edmonton side, Books, you know, tough blow to the Oilers organization, just psychologically, to lose for the second straight year to the same team. And obviously, you know, game six this time around after going to game seven the previous year. How do you look at the road ahead for the Oilers and the job that their front office has to, you know, make sure that this wasn't a 2-year window of its closing, but that they can be consistently competitive going forward?
Going to be tough for me. This is different on that side of the ledger. You know, obviously contractually with McDavid, you know, his situation here in the near future. The goaltending is an outlier. And as much as, you know, it's a business. So Stuart Skinner's a fantastic human being, great pro, great teammate. They got what they could get out of Pickard, but that's such a massive outlier. And they can't afford to make another mistake, i.e. the Jack Campbell mistake, to spend money in the wrong area on their next goaltender. They don't have a lot coming in the minors, guys. They don't have a lot of draft capital. So this is going to be a heavy lift for them. But they've got some star players there. And, you know, they're going to need some change. They're going to need to change up the DNA a little bit. One thing that and I'm interested in what your take is on this, too, because, again, I'm in a mood when I watch certain things, and I don't like when they're really pushed up against it, even at the top of the table, because McDavid's the best player in the world. Dreisaitl, he's a German, and they carry themselves a certain way. But I just felt the look on the bench last night, that look of being defeated and almost borderline sulking about it a few times, that drives me crazy. And I think that has to get figured out as well, because that's part of the DNA.
Well, and I would point to, you know, McDavid after the game, like, oh, we were just banging our head against the wall, doing the same thing over and over again. Like, does that speak to some frustration with individually, I'm sure, for him, but maybe to how the rest of the team was performing as well? I know exactly what you're talking about. A part of me thinks, like, they just read the writing on the wall the same way we did. You know what I mean? That they're like, yeah, Florida's better than us right now, and there's not a whole lot we can do about it. But I also understand, like, that's not a satisfactory answer from your best players, especially when they're Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl, who are so clearly, you know, head and shoulders above the rest of the guys on the roster.
I read years and years and years ago, I read the Wayne Gretzky book about when the Oilers, their dynasty team in the 80s, they lost to the Islanders, their first go around in the Stanley Cup final. And they are walking, Wayne Gretzky says in his book, on the way past the Islanders dressing room at the end of the series, he took a peek over the curtain, if you will, and he just expected them all to be partying and, you know, having a few wobbly pops and whatever. And they were doing that. But what really caught his eye was the sacrifice and, like, how beat up they were, like what it took out of them to get it done. And I feel like the Oil haven't had everybody going to the best of their ability all the time when they got to the Stanley Cup final. And that could be part of the makeup of the team. It could be part of, like, you know, like Jeff Skinner last night, and there's a play in the neutral zone. I don't know if you guys saw it. Like, he complained about a play the referee didn't make a call, and he was slapping his stick on the ice like a Timbits hockey player. And, you know, that's just not good. It's not good in the Stanley Cup final. And, you know, then you get in front of the media after and you have certain types of answers. I really think that they were mentally defeated by a team that's just built to win and play the game any way you want to play it. And Sasha Barkov and company did a hell of a job neutralizing two of the best players in the world and bringing out the worst version of their personalities in the process. And that's not to say they're not two of the best players in the world still, but they're chasing championship pedigree, and they have to have a takeaway from this as well.
Books, it looks to me like the Panthers have an opportunity here to look. We know windows never last as long in pro sports as we think they will the day after a team wins a championship. But it looks like they're positioned to take a real run at being an elite team again, a team with a shot, right? And I'm not going to give them more than that, but a team with a shot. Vegas has them priced out as the second shortest odds to win the cup the day after the cup was awarded to them. What's that going to take? What's continuity going to take from a Panthers perspective as we sort of shoot the starting gun and get started with the offseason?
Well, obviously it's going to come down to how they want to spend their money in free agency, and the top three at the top, Bennett, Ekblad, and Marchand, you know, how do you want to spread the wealth around? And it's going to get dicey that way. They do have some players waiting in the wings. You know, I said Samoskovich, but he's a different type of player, guys. He's a skill guy. Where those other guys that I mentioned there are, you know, that grit and determination type of player. I think they've got just over, you probably have it in front of you, but it's over $19 million, I think, in cap space to spend, to work with.
Yeah, roughly 20.
They got some hard decisions. They got some hard decisions to make. They could keep the band together or bring most of it back together. Bennett winning the Conn Smythe, like, what's that look like on the open market?
Seriously.
Now, like, cost-wise, if he wants to go? What's Ekblad look like? So to me, from my view from the top is this. Marchand's going to want to, on his very last contract of his career, he's won two cups now. He's probably taken less to stay in Boston over the years. If he can get paid handsomely somewhere else, I think he's going to do it. Bennett is going to get a big number somewhere. And if they're looking at Verhaeghe money to keep him in Florida, I don't think that's not going to be good enough. So they're going to have to go above that. So now they're going to have to get uncomfortable, call it 8.5 or 9. You're getting tracking towards Barkey's next deal. He's only making 10 right now, which is a crazy number. And then where is it with Ekblad? I think the Seth Jones acquisition gave them a fallback there. Because Ek's going to want to raise. And I will tell you this. Is Ekblad not as valuable as Darnell Nurse? Like, I think he is. And Darnell Nurse is, what, 9.5 or 9.25, somewhere around there? So that's a $2 million raise for Ek if he wants to stay in Florida at that number. And all of a sudden, you got no money left in the bank. You're spent, just like that. Hard to do.
And one last one, Books. We're running low on time, but I'll give you a chance to just give me an answer to this. One need. Canucks come out of the offseason with just one piece. What piece does it have to be, in your view?
The most important piece in the offseason, provided that you do not make a deal, a Pettersson deal here in the next 2 weeks, is the very best version of Pettersson, and that he has to figure it out, because everything else is going to be built around him being better. So I think everything is predicated on him having the best summer of his life and getting back to almost, and hopefully back to form, as close to his form as he was in the past. That's an easy answer, but I think that that's exactly what it is. If he's not moved, they are making the decision, we're going to continue to build around him, and he better be better, or else it's going to be a long winter for Adam Foote and the Canucks.
Books, great stuff as always, man. Really appreciate your perspective on the Panthers and what we just saw between the Panthers and the Oilers. And we'll do this next week. We'll really dive into the draft. I guess what? We'll be 2 days out from the draft at that point. So we'll dive in on the draft and the offseason next week. And thank you as always.
It's great to talk to you guys. Thank you for having me on. I'll talk to you from L.A. next week.
Sounds good. That is Jason Bukala from Sportsnet, former director of amateur scouting in the NHL, and of course, most notably with the Florida Panthers. And a little parting gift here, or parting note for our listeners, and this is from Andy Strickland, and I checked. There is no update on this tweet like there was on the one yesterday that I read, Drancer. But Andy Strickland reporting, Trent Frederick in Edmonton closing in on an extension which is believed to be an eight-year deal in the range of $4 million per season. That's from Andy Strickland. So Edmonton getting to work early on their offseason business and appear to be signing Trent Frederick to an eight-year extension worth $4 million a year.
Good for Trent Frederick. Congratulations to him.
Mm-hmm.
And congratulations to Canucks fans that like rooting against the Oilers.
Yes, that is that's a wild one. That's all I'll say there. That is the eight-year deal for Trent Frederick. When I saw that this morning, the tweet out there, I think it was from Jim Matheson, I was like, pardon me, Trent Frederick?
I didn't think there was going to be deals that I'd be like, that's too much for too long. I really thought that wasn't going to happen.
And NHL GM said, hold my beer. We can always make it happen.
I just don't see it. I really don't. He doesn't have productive touches that move play along or help create an environment where you're more likely to score the next goal, period. And so
it's also
anyway,
just
good luck to him.
It's like you're when you do that 8-year deal for a bottom six type player, and obviously they think he has middle six potential for them, but you're betting that it'll look great in years like 4 through 8, right? You're like, okay, mm-hmm. Hey, but like that's when it will really feel the savings. But like this team needs to be good next year and the year after. That's when they need to prioritize, not years 4 through 8 of the Trent Frederick deal, when even if your bet hits, like that's the time you would really be happy about signing the deal. So I don't get this one at all from Edmonton's perspective, but that's the latest per Andrew Strickland that they're going to lock him up to an 8-year deal. All right. Thank you to everyone for listening. Again, we're going to do the crossover tomorrow, so we'll have Don Taylor and Rick Dhaliwal on the show just a day late. Looking forward to that. And we will be back here tomorrow for more Canucks talk on Sportsnet 650.